you for continuing to tune in here to the live stream. I am David Tessar, and thank you for continuing to watch this Channel 9 Live. Today we have a special episode here of The Edge Show. Now, normally we do a weekly show focused on IT professionals out there today, but we have a topic of DevOps today, and we have some DevOps experts here today for you to ask your questions, so make sure you answer them below here. And so could all of you here just give us a little bit of idea of what your role is inside your company, and so we can get started.
Sure. I'm Richard Sirother. I'm the Director of Product Management for the CenturyLink Cloud, and I'm part of our engineering team and get to witness firsthand how we do DevOps to improve our delivery pipeline.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So, hey, I'm Mickey Gousset. I'm a principal consultant at Infront Consulting. I'm an ALM MVP, so I do ALM stuff for fun. In my day job, I work in the System Center world.
And you know, all of you have sessions here at TechEd, so so maybe that's the other angle. So what is your session?
Yeah,
about?
I did not flog that at all.
Yeah.
My session today is on building resilient cloud apps, so how do you build bulletproof apps there, and tomorrow's on DevOps and how did the open source ecosystem work with the Microsoft platform.
Okay.
We had a pre-con on Sunday, DevOps for Developers, where we talked about DevOps from a developer perspective and how the tooling can help developers more work in that world.
Well, that's quite ironic. I had a pre-con on DevOps for IT pros. Well, this is already a start of ops and dev starting to talk, right? There we go.
Absolutely.
All right. And
I'm Bradley Millington, and I'm a program manager at Microsoft. So I work on the Windows Azure portal. And specifically, I'm working on the integration of the Visual Studio Online scenarios into that Azure portal to kind of create some interesting synergies between kind of the operations side in terms of Azure resources and the developer side in terms of Visual Studio experiences. So, working on the new portal. The session I had yesterday was entitled The Future of DevOps and kind of covered a lot of those scenarios in terms of Visual Studio Online integration as well as some operations and analytics scenarios in the new portal.
Yeah, that's very cool stuff. DevOps has a lot of different angles to it, and obviously, products is a very interesting thing, and we'll get there today. But I wanted to start off all the way, I'd say, high up at the people level, right? Because DevOps, we know, really, if you're doing DevOps, you're going to be having developers, operations, and even the business kind of working together.
Sure.
So what I would love to know is, what are some scenarios where maybe you've seen people either be a real problem or where it really worked well of those folks working together in environments?
Hmm.
Yeah. Does anybody want to chime in on that one? Yeah.
I could start.
Yeah, sure.
In our company, we did that transformation. As you said, it's not just Dev and Ops. It's almost misnamed. I'm product management. We're integrated. QA's integrated. Business side's integrated. If the whole org isn't on track, it's really not going to work. So you do hit problems when people like being silos themselves, don't do a lot of information sharing, and all of a sudden you lose that transparency, which is really important to whole points getting rid of waste and making yourself more efficient. If you have people who are guarding information, that really puts a wrench in the whole process. So, we've seen that, and you just kind of work through that. You make sure that you've got a senior team of people who collaborate well.
So how did you start that out? Like, tell me, like, how was it before, and then how did things kind of change for your organization?
Yeah, before there were more silos with Dev and Ops. You had, leaders who didn't necessarily work closely together. Now, the VP of Ops and VP of Engineering could deliver each other's status sessions. They're daily stand-ups. There's things that we've simply done to make sure that these teams have to work together in a good way. So now if there's a crisis, you instantly know how to form teams. There's no quick scrambling around, who do I grab? So doing all that work ahead of time means when you need it, it's actually there, and people have that relationship and know what tools to use, how to jump in and fix something.
Did you actually see some improvements in metrics or certain business outcomes when you started doing that?
Absolutely. So we went from pushing our platform to 2 data centers in the world in about 3-4 hours to pushing to 11 data centers in 15 minutes.
Okay.
And so even just that, how did we improve how we deploy our software and push it out there? All sorts of those sort of metrics of just bug fix turnarounds and all those things that the whole org has to be in line on to push that often, troubleshoot that quickly, meet your SLAs.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, all right. You're the principal consultant. I mean, you've seen folks that, stories of other folks that have done things.
Well, yes, and we're seeing a lot of clients where before it was, you had developers and you had the IT folks, and they really were silos, and they were stay out of our world. You throw it over the wall, and the developers don't care anymore. And now I'm going into clients, and they're actually wanting to come talk and ask the questions. Mm. How do we start working better together? It's no longer, just DevOps as this mysterious term. They're wanting to actually implement it. And then that's where we start talking about, well, this is how all the tools you have, this is from a tooling perspective how we can integrate it. But then you also have to have that talk about the process perspective and the people perspective. It's a mindset that has to change. And as you've mentioned, not just in the grunts in the field, but in the higher level management as well.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing, this is another interesting kind of angle too, is, are you seeing people bring in new folks, or, are they kind of, forming based on the existing folks and teams that you have that are out there?
Yeah. From my perspective, it's usually they're taking existing teams.
Yep.
And some places are trying to make a DevOps team where it's, they make a team of people,
right,
and they classify them as DevOps. Others are trying to just say, okay, we're not going to classify a specific team, but we're just going to all be nice to each other and start working better
together.
And both have their pluses and minuses, but both, at least the companies are trying to do something to make everybody play nicer.
Yeah. And what are you seeing as the kind of the big push to get going with that? Like why are you seeing these companies starting to want to do that?
Because they're realizing that just because that the developer's throwing it over the wall, the operations, it's not necessarily getting monitored or like it needs to be, or if it is getting monitored, the developers aren't responding as quickly because developers don't want to get in the IT pro tools, or the IT pros don't want to get in the dev tools. So it's, several different reasons.
Lots of finger pointing, like you did that, it's you. And then, you get the escalation of things going up the chain. And then hours later, then it gets fixed versus, if you're a team, right, then
things
are a lot faster.
I think I just saw yesterday the stat again. I mean, almost 40% of budgets in IT are now outside of IT. So if you don't do this, it's almost a survival thing. I mean, at some point, especially with how many hosted software packages and so forth. With a credit card, I can provision ERP now.
Yeah.
I can stand up I don't need those fighting dev and ops guys. I can literally stand this up myself. So if you want to deliver modern software, you really have no choice but to move to a more collaborative, frequent release program, because these three-year projects that always miss dates, we're just past that, right? The expectations have changed, even by business users who see how quickly everybody else can update software on their social sites or on the apps they use.
Yep.
Why can't my team do that?
Yeah.
So I think it's survival as much as anything.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think I've thought about this too. It's like, the ops guy, he's going to have to get the application some way or another, right? So even if you theoretically don't want to ever work with that dev guy that's out there, like, you're going to have to now take what he's written or have this issue like is kind of brought up, right, of going behind the ops guy's back because you're the no guy, right? Don't be that guy. Don't be the ops guy that's the no guy, right? If you start working together, you start having, right, ideally less, like you mentioned, less fixes, less, issues that are cropping up, and and all kinds of benefits start to happen.
I can talk a little bit how DevOps is integrated into the culture of my team as well.
So, yeah.
One of the things that, we're making a shift as a company is kind of much more toward the services and devices world, obviously. And as we start becoming a services company, really sort of has to get into the culture of everybody that works there. So when we come up with new features or developing kind of new services for Azure, we really have to think upfront about how we're going to log, how we're going to be able to trace exact user paths through all of our services, how we actually create automated kind of runners and alerts for every new feature that we light up. And we basically integrate those kind of runners and alerts into dashboards that that our operations team can monitor on a 24/7 basis. So we've just set up like a large operations center for Azure. It's kind of a new, obviously we've been monitoring it as we go, but we've got a kind of a new facility for doing that.
Yeah.
Runs 24/7, and they have monitors and dashboards looking at the network, the entire kind of network topology, all the runners and alerts, and you can basically see like the moment a service goes red or even goes like slightly yellow, they can kind of tap an on-call list, know exactly who on the development team owns that feature, and who they can contact kind of 24/7. So we're kind of really making that transition into a services company, and all of us have to kind of think about, is it our week to be on call, and how are we going to dispatch to the right people? And it's been kind of an interesting transition, I think, for Microsoft as a company to go from that box product kind of thinking into that 24/7.
You think about who your customer is, right? I mean, if you're an ops person, you're a developer, your customer is often the ops team. It's not the end user. It's the people who have to run and maintain your software for you when it's at a service. So you just think differently, I think, now about who are my actual stakeholders, and let's cater to them. Let's not make their life harder, because we're all delivering a service here ongoing. We're not just dumping it off and moving on to the next thing.
They have to be educated about the feature as well. So with each feature, we create what we call a troubleshooting guide, a TSG. Mm-hmm. And every feature has a corresponding TSG that when the feature goes, you know, into a certain state, and we categorize the different states, you know, in terms of severity level, they can kind of tap a TSG, know exactly how to kind of do that frontline first investigation themselves, and then, you know, that gets them so far. Hopefully they can resolve the issue just by reading the TSG that was written by the dev team that created the feature. And if they can't take it all the way to conclusion, then they know who to tap to kind of go that next level of investigation. So it's really important that we kind of keep that frontline operations team as educated about the kind of inner workings of the features as we can.
Yeah, it's this topic is ringing all kinds of bells for me about the three ways principle.
Sure.
Right, where the first way, right, like you guys are talking, is development is kind of like the business, and ops is like the customer, and where you're kind of catering almost to the ops person to help, you know, deliver that service together.
Yep.
Right. You know, the other thing is, and another thing related to that is like this concept of infrastructure as code. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like how can you make a more repeatable process, you know, from that get go of development, and even if from QA to test to, you know, pre-prod or prod or whatever, however you slice out your environments goes, you've got a really consistent experience for ops to kind of help move things through that list, right? And there's no surprises when you get over that wall to development, right? And as an IT guy, right, this is a kind of an area where I would see, you know, you use your existing skills. If you've got PowerShell skills or other kinds of scripting skills, that, you know, could be really handy to provision infrastructure, right? So what are ways that you guys see that really, you know, playing a role with that kind of automation and infrastructure as code type of thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's an amazing change. We were just talking before we went on air about even dealing with training environments 10 or 15 years ago, where you'd go build out 50 machines and have to fix it when someone inevitably broke something. But treating infrastructure as something I check into source control as a config file, that then my developers all get the same workstation when I use certain technologies, or I can make sure that there's no more "it works on my machine" anymore, right? That is no longer a developer excuse, because we're literally from ops to dev working on the same stack that can be reset if the configuration drifts to the same setting over and over again. And again, as a developer, I can pull one config every morning and rebuild my environment from scratch in a matter of minutes. That's amazing. I mean, that's a huge game changer for speeding up development, getting rid of that waste of "this doesn't work," or "well, how come this app pool has a different identity than this one?" Like, get rid of all that. It should all be nicely standardized.
Totally.
And that's what we've been doing at our company. When we spin up training machines, when we spin up, you know, testing VMs, anything like that, we've gotten to where we don't just go to the console and use the console to spin it up. We write PowerShell scripts to do it. So therefore, it's repeatable, and other people in the company can then use the same code that you've used to make sure they spin up the exact same kind of environment, you know, 2 months down the road.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is very much related to the new kind of Azure Resource Manager that we've kind of integrated at the kind of the API layer for Azure. One of the goals for that is obviously we want to be able to kind of orchestrate kind of repeatable deployments, repeatable ways to kind of create and associate resources to each other. We want that API layer to be consistent across all the different kind of resource providers in Azure, and be able to automate that from any client, whether it's, you know, the command line, or, you know, the IDE, or the UI or the portal. So Azure Resource Manager, kind of at its core, is really about creating that reliable, repeatable deployment and configuration processes across all of Azure.
Yeah. I mean, I know in my session I do some of that about ARM. Now, you know, I think the big difference there is, right, you're going from a script to of pulling and pushing together, you know, a collection of whatever other things you may have, right, to you've got one standard resource group template, JSON file, you know, where you could do everything on the list, and it's a collection, right? So I could see how that really helps to, you know, change the game, I think, a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of, you know, what about, I don't want to leave out this concept of process, right? So, you know, there's obviously, like, I think a lot of companies, and at least IT guys out there, you generally get that concept of ITIL or you've got some kind of ticket management or change management system. How would you say that really plays a part or a role in DevOps? And I mean, some people are like, well, do you need it maybe, right? Or, you know, the dev guys, I mean, do you see that happening? You know, kind of like, I just want to deploy stuff. I don't need to worry about you, right? What do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, I worked for a large enterprise IT shop before I took my current role, and I always often try to wear that hat when I think about these things. So do most people look at this and go, that's really nice for that cool startup or that, you know, quirky band of developers in org. That never works at a company that has regulated apps or, you know, isn't a healthcare or government space or something. That's interesting. But it really does when you think about it. I mean, how secure is it to have people manually making these changes and then writing their signature on something? Wouldn't it be better to have a process that you know simply works because it's automated and scripted? Is it developers really logging into production and changing stuff, or is it giving controlled access through certain platforms to let them do things? So I think it is a difference, right? I mean, change management. I mean, in an Azure world where I can resize and spin up images in minutes, do I need this rigorous process of justifying hardware anymore, or do we just treat OS as kind of free and that gets charged back to a business unit? So it does force you to change your thinking. You can't take your old change management process, config management, all those things the exact same way and have them work in the system. I do think you have to rethink. Let's assume everything we did before was wrong. How would some of that layer on in this new model? And some of it's great. Keep your ITIL processes, all that. But you got to bring it up to the modern era of trying to remove the waste of your process to do things faster.
Yeah.
And what I find with that also from a process perspective is, as most people are going to tell you, they don't like process. Don't just let me get it done.
Yeah.
So, but process is important. And when you start talking about ITIL, you start talking about change, mm-hmm. incident. So, but if you can allow people to have to deal with that process in their own tools without having to necessarily go, okay, now I've got to go over here to this tool to do this and this tool to do this. Mm-hmm. If my part of the process as a developer, I can stay in Visual Studio, then I'm going to follow that process and I'm going to, you know, keep doing what I'm supposed to do. So having that tool integration there is very important in my perspective to help further this whole DevOps calls.
Good point.
Yeah, making it easy at the end user side of things, yeah. So are there cases where you've seen process really help things or hinder, right, in environments? Yeah?
For the most part, for me, I've always seen process ultimately help.
Okay.
Usually I see you see process coming in, like, for example, there was one company that could just spin up, the devs could spin up VMs whenever they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just spinning up VMs, you know, doing willy-nilly. So the company instead went through a self-service portal where the devs could pick the VMs they wanted, pick the resources that they needed. Then it went to an approval stage. As soon as it got approved, it got automatically spun up. And then 48 hours later, it was automatically torn down.
Yeah.
So by going through that process, they were making more valued use of the resources that they had, but it still wasn't impacting the devs' ability to do what they needed to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, makes total sense. And I think this is, you know, this is an area where, you know, IT, you have a really great opportunity here to really help enable and empower your dev guys to where they actually want to maybe come and talk to you and say, well, that's pretty cool, you know, spin up service, you got to maybe click a, you know, self-service template or something, now I've got a new dev environment, right? Or, hey, you know, helping you to have a automated infrastructure as a code script that spins up their environment in collaboration with development, right? So what are, we've got one question here in a minute, but what are some areas that you see ops really helping devs? Or like as a developer side of the house, right, where are some areas where you would like ops to come to you with assistance?
Well, I think that is a great post this last week by Donnie Burkholz, who works for Redmonk, the analyst firm, saying that when we think about DevOps, we often put more pressure on the dev to know ops. Like, right, devs have to learn configuration management tools. Dev need to understand infrastructure. But there's an infrastructure responsibility, too. And really the pivot, his impression, I think it's right, is devs take responsibility for the apps wherever they live, production, dev, test. But infrastructure really takes responsibility for production and dev tests. Like, you have to give me stable infrastructure everywhere. And that's your job as infrastructure, is don't just say, I'm keeping prod up and running. I need it good everywhere. But in exchange, dev's going to help you take some of that ownership of the apps that sit in prod.
Yeah.
So nobody should be taking on more work. You're just kind of changing your focus a bit.
Cool. Yeah.
So again, from system-specific information, System Center Operations Manager, the APM, Application Performance Monitoring, is where I start to see the initial inroads that make the developers and operations really start working together better. Because with APM, we start pulling in all this, you know, We can easily find if there's issues. We can give stack traces. We can do IntelliTrace. We can send all that information directly to a work item in TFS. Mm-hmm. So a developer gets a work item in TFS with the IntelliTrace on there, opens the IntelliTrace file, instantly goes to the problem, can go back and forth. And he can work the alert from SCOM without ever actually having to go into SCOM. He can do what he needs to do in his tool. The operations manager guy knows what's happening in his tool. So both worlds are staying separate, but they're still being integrated. And that's where we're really starting to see, from my perspective on a daily basis with the clients, DevOps starting to form.
Cool. Yeah, and how does the new Azure Management Portal kind of help with some of those things? Yeah,
I guess I want to come back to an earlier question. Yeah. Or I understood the question to be around ticketing systems and processes.
Yeah, sure.
How those help. Yeah. So one of the things we've done with the new portal is really we have a way that we're maintaining state for users so that we know exactly kind of the state of any given journey that they're in. And we want to integrate that back to our support processes where we can create sort of ticketing systems that surface in the portal. Users can, be doing something in the middle of the portal, know exactly where they're at, and if they encounter a problem, an issue, whatever, they can kind of take a snapshot, and we can use the kind of, kind of user settings and persistence that we do kind of regularly with the portal to kind of save a snapshot of exactly what they're doing and be able to, attach that to the ticketing system and get it straight to the ops folks so that they could kind of unpack, exactly the state of the world at the moment that the user encountered a given issue. So we're really trying to think about how we engineer things from the get-go to kind of think about supportability and get that integrated into the ticketing system.
Cool.
This is a vision, something that we're working on. It's not implemented yet, but
that's
thinking
awesome.
About those things.
That's awesome. All right, so I want to make sure we have time for questions. So we have Rich Siegel. It says, Puppet and Chef typically store their configs in version control systems like Git. Mm-hmm. This keeps the config transparent in a mutable timeline and outside of a SQL database. Do you see System Center going that route, or do you see PowerShell desired state configuration replacing System Center functionality around declarative deployments? Wow, long question. Do any of you want to try and tackle that one?
I see PowerShell desired state configuration becoming very important. I'm not sure if I can answer his question directly, but I mean, DSC right now, they've announced the fact that it does, Chef does integrate with DSC. Is System Center going to go the route of storing the configs outside of SQL? I don't know if they are or not. I really can't answer that. My look at that more from a standpoint of, is PowerShell DSC going to be something that we need to look at to help with our deployments in the future? Yes. If you're looking at TFS and using release management in TFS, and if you're looking at PowerShell DSC, all of those things are going to work well together to help you get your releases out the way you want to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, System Center, I see it as a really critical platform, right? And how you intend to put some automation things inside of that, that's kind of your call, right? So like with PowerShell DSC, you may put that in an orchestrator runbook and have that thing fire off a script to provision stuff, right? But hopefully that kind of answers it there. So I think we've got some other questions down below there if you want to chime them up there on the list. But what are some other areas where you... like with specific products? I know open source is another one. So we mentioned Puppet and Chef. Where do you see, open source playing a role with Microsoft, or what are some integration pieces that you really find enjoyable there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's some of the focus of my talk. So I think it's interesting to finally see some of these platforms coming to Windows. They all started on the Linux world, probably because they're open source themselves. They're working with the easiest platform they can work on from a licensing perspective and what their people use. But tools like all those configuration management tools, Puppet Chef and others, Vagrant for dev environments, where I can now use Hyper-V or VirtualBox or others to stand up a VM, regardless of platform, with a single script that provisions things on them, is awesome. There's a lot of that set of tools is coming to the Microsoft platform. There are a couple of gaps, but at this point, you can at least run agents on Windows boxes. In the future, hopefully, we see you can even run the master server for something like Puppet or Chef on a Windows box. Right now, you still need a Linux box, but there's a nice movement towards that. The Microsoft Open Technologies Group has done some pretty cool work in that space to keep accelerating that. So it's actually pretty promising that you don't have to ask your dev and ops team to use different tools for different platforms, which is not increasing your efficiency. It's making it harder. So that's a nice story now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, at Microsoft, we want to, you know, obviously we have the full OpenTech team. We want to embrace, you know, if you've got existing heavy investments in Puppet or Chef or other open source tools, that's fine. You know, just, you know, pick, maybe there's other suites around there that will complement those tools that are out there. And you know, like you said, interoperability, right? Puppet, Chef, you can deploy straight to Azure. So, sure. You know, that's all good, right? How about you in the System Center space? Is there just particular ways that you see people using System Center in the DevOps kind of world?
They're starting to use it more from a self-service perspective. So okay. Self-service is really the big term we're hearing a lot now. So they're implementing Service Manager where you can have self-service service requests through the portal where you can easily have a step where then that gets approved, and as soon as it's approved, then they're using Orchestrator to try to automate stuff on the back end, automate spinning up those VMs, automate creating whatever you needed to create an AD or working with whatever third-party system you needed to work with. Orchestrator is really starting to become a strong de facto tool for integrating all of the systems and doing all the automation that we want to see behind the scenes.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's kind of cool because it's like, you know, that on that process flow, it's like not only can you spin up the environment, but you need to fire off an email and have, you know, some custom ticket system and write something in there. You've got all kinds of power there. So,
sure.
And last but not least, yeah. How about we obviously are touting this new Azure portal, and we mentioned DevOps a lot. How do we see that really playing a role, and what's kind of our background on why we created it and whatnot?
Yeah. So the vision for the portal really is to kind of, first and foremost, we just introduced the new portal and we're introducing another. So you kind of, why are we doing it? That's sort of a good question. So one of the things we realize is we really want to create an ecosystem, not first-party services and third-party services, including the great array of open-source technologies that there are out there. We want those to integrate nicely. And what we sort of realize is the design of the old portal really wasn't designed to scale beyond in the tens to maybe 100 different kinds of extensions playing with each other. And each of those extensions to the portal is sort of delivering their own UI in kind of a siloed space. You know, every provider to the portal is kind of authoring their own UI, by accessing the DOM directly. What we wanted to do is kind of create an experience that allowed all of these, first can scale to thousands of extensions and really, you know, create the ecosystem we're hoping to see, but also to kind of unbox the UI and allow these services to kind of play in the same UI space, but in a consistent sort of way. So we've delivered a framework that allows these services to kind of collaborate, but use kind of a consistent UI metaphor for interacting with each other. So that's part of it. Customizability. So we really want people to be able to make the portal their own. So I mentioned kind of unboxing UI. We want people to take parts from different elements of services and be able to put them together into kind of views and lenses that are customized for the things they care about. If you're an ops guy, you can look at analytics and operations and statistics and charts. If you're a dev, you can kind of piece together your builds and your processes and your code and your check-ins kind of all in one view across multiple services. So it's really about scale, about consistency, customizability, ecosystem. And I guess I want to touch a little bit on the question of open source as well, because mentioned
sure.
How's that relating.
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly with the third-party ecosystem, we want the first and third-party services to work really well together. Part of creating the consistent API layer for Azure is to allow all these services to kind of interoperate and collaborate against a consistent set of APIs, so it's easy to kind of stitch together multiple services to do things like deployment operations and so on. And then the portal itself is actually embracing open source as well in terms of how we build the portal. So, I think there's been quite a culture shift at Microsoft in terms of our ability to kind of consume and use open source technologies in the construction of our own products. So we've been using things like Knockout. We use things like D3 for the charting that we're doing. In a lot of ways, we're both trying to create an ecosystem where Microsoft and open source can collaborate, and internally we're kind of seeing the benefits of that in the way we construct our own software as well.
Cool. All right. We have time for one last question here. It says, Linux folks have Docker for shipping containers of apps to the cloud. Mm-hmm. Do we see this paradigm moving to Windows or extending Docker to support Windows? And then it says, server app V is rumored to be... we're not going to talk about the the future of app V. I don't think anybody even here can answer that one. But the first half, I think, is still a good general question.
I was hoping Docker would come up. I mean, Docker's the one area where there's just... a gap in what Windows can do. And for people who don't know Docker, it's the ability to do OS virtualization and give you an isolated environment container within an OS that gives you isolated network, file system, resources. And so it's been great for DevOps people who want to push, you know, an entire VM and push little nodes that have your database on it, your web app server, you're using it for testing, you're using it for all sorts of things. It doesn't run anywhere on Windows right now. It uses native LXC, you know, the way Linux works. Could it work on Windows? Potentially. I mean, there's maybe a mismatch there on what that is. That team has mentioned they may come to Windows at some point, which would be great. I think it'd be a great feature for people who want to carve up an OS. So
yeah,
that
so
team's mentioned they may. I hope they do, because it's a great functionality.
Yeah, so I think, you know, also there's a lot of other mechanisms, even that are open source, for creating that infrastructure as a code and having, you know, that container for an app, right? I mean, we mentioned the resource groups. That's one of our versions, right? You've got PowerShell. You've got Windows Azure Markup Language. You have even Puppet and Chef, right? So there's a lot of different means. Docker.io is one that just doesn't, for whatever reason, they haven't, you know, had the integration with us, but there's a lot of other means for that. So, are we, you know, I think we're, you know, lots of choices for folks that are out there today. So, yeah. So, I mean, any kind of final closing thoughts on, you know, tips for people to kind of get started with moving forward in the kind of DevOps space?
I guess it's the don't try to do it all at once, which most people understand with any kind of movement thing is you're going to fail if you think you're going to do that. But at the same time, I think as you mentioned, people want to streamline processes. I mean, this is something I think that people do receive well is this concept. The key is maybe starting to introduce some technologies, building up small teams that start to do this end-to-end for their apps and their projects, and that starts to evangelize broader. But then you do need that executive leadership. I think as you mentioned, if someone at the top isn't saying, this is how we will function, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
And just start. Do something. Also, don't get that paralysis analysis where you're just kind of, you know, we want to do DevOps, but we don't know where to go. Do something. If you mess it up, you mess it up.
Cool. All right. Awesome. Well, I think with that, we are going to wrap. And stay tuned. We are continuing on with this live stream for another session here.